Hello, everyone. Can you hear me all right? I probably don't even need this in this room. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our Australian session. I am Arthur Edson, Canadian barrister from Vancouver. As a Canadian, it's an honor and a privilege for me to be able to introduce to you my Australian Commonwealth cousins. According to a 2013 World BBC Service poll, 79% of Australians view Canada positively, with only 7% expressing a negative view. My learned friends have assured me they are not part of that 7%, correct?
He's changed his mind.
No, I love
it. We have three distinguished presenters with their detailed bios are in the programs that you have. All three are important thought leaders from Australia. Our first presenter will be Associate Professor Neil Foster, Associate Professor at Newcastle University Faculty of Business and Law. Professor Foster's principal teaching and research is in the law of torts and freedom of religion. Professor Foster designed the curriculum for and taught one of the first law and religion credit courses in Australia. Following Professor Foster's remarks, our second presenter will be Professor Neville Rocco, adjunct professor at Notre Dame Law School, Sydney, and adjunct professor at Adelaide Law School. Neville is a good friend. He's a barrister. He's a silk, which means a lot to me as a barrister. He's practiced law for a number of years from his chambers in Adelaide. Professor Rocco's principal teachings and research is in freedom of religion, constitutional, and constitutional law. My favorite story about Neville, I'll be really quick. Winston Churchill defined barrister. Neville and I are both barristers, defined barrister as one half gentleman, one half bulldog. And so that Neville fulfills that description very well. Following Neville's remarks, we'll then hear from Dr. Nigel Zimmerman, personal secretary to the Most Reverend Peter Comensoli. Dr. Zimmerman is a lecturer in theology at the University of Notre Dame, Sydney. My task as moderator, as I understand it, is to ask the presenters to take no more than 15 minutes in anticipating of there being time for questions before our time is spent. If Professor Foster is ready, the podium is his.
Thank you very much, Arthur. Microphone working and all those sorts of things, great. It's a great joy and pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank the organisers of the symposium for the invitation to come, and Neville for organising me to get over here and all those sorts of things. And it's been a great pleasure to meet colleagues who are interested in this area. And the artwork on the first slide is just to remind you that Australia has lovely beaches and all those sorts of things. Not that we wish to denigrate Provo in any way, but it's a nice place to be. Australia, unlike the United States of America, has not had a long history of controversy over freedom of religion issues. Perhaps the historical origins of the countries might tell us a reason why. This lovely country was settled by many, particularly we're conscious of that here in Utah, whose religious commitments led them to leave their own countries or homes to find a place to practice their own religion. My country was settled by convicts who were dragged out against their wills. But as a result, Australia has been a fairly, broadly speaking, secular country for many years. But as part of a globalised and multicultural Western world, legal issues of religion are becoming much more important, and part of that was the reason why I was able to persuade my law school to agree last year to start offering an elective for law students in law and religion, of which there are not that many in Australia still, and it's good to have an opportunity to talk about those things with students. Issues that have come up in there are three important cases that have come up in the last year or so in Australia which deal with these issues, and I'm going to talk about two of them. My colleague Neville will be talking about the third, which is an important decision of our High Court on the question of same-sex marriage, which of course is a very hot topic, even developments in that happening here in the US today, of course. So two cases I'm going to be discussing relate to in the area of discrimination in relation to sexual orientation and also an issue to do with language. One of them comes from a state court and deals with the extent to which a Christian organisation offering services in a secular marketplace is entitled to be true to its beliefs in the way that it offers those services. The other case raises the interesting and somewhat vexed question of whether a religious organisation can decline to offer services that are seen as important by some of its own members, and whether there can be a freedom of religion claim brought by members of a church against the church. These questions, while interesting in themselves, also provide good examples of the broad spectrum of issues that are starting to face believers these days in the modern world. To what extent will religious viewpoints which historically have supported certain institutions of society at large be overturned when society's moral perceptions change? To what extent will the broader community accommodate religious organisations and believers when they no longer share the majority views on moral issues? And how should disputes within religious organisations be dealt with? The first case I want to deal with is called Christian Youth Camps Limited and Cobourg Community Health Service Limited. And it deals with the question of a Christian organisation operating in the marketplace, as it were. The group Cobourg, as you can see their logo at the top of the slide there, Cobourg Community Health, runs a project called Way Out, designed, they say, to provide support and suicide prevention services to same-sex attracted young people. The coordinator of the project approached CYC, Christian Youth Camps, which is a camping organisation connected with the Christian Brethren denomination, to inquire about making a booking at a Phillip Island campsite that is generally made available to community groups. Mr. Rowe from the organisation informed person who rang from Cobourg that the CYC group would not be happy with making a booking for the group, which encouraged a homosexual lifestyle, as he put it. Part of the conversation was that she made it very clear that the purpose of running the camp was to teach young people that homosexuality was a natural and normal part of life, and this was a perspective with which Mr. Rowe disagreed and said that his organisation disagreed. So there was a refusal to proceed with the booking. The reason for the refusal was connected with CYC's view of the philosophy for support for homosexuality as being contrary to the scriptures. This then was the subject of a complaint made to initially the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal under Victorian anti-discrimination law, which makes it unlawful to discriminate against someone on a number of grounds, including sexual orientation. The tribunal, constituted by Judge Hample from the Victorian County Court, ruled against the CYC and Mr. Rowan, or that they had unlawfully discriminated and should be jointly liable to pay a fine of $5,000. The primary liability imposed was under the Equal Opportunity Act of Victoria, as I say, which prohibited same-sex sexual orientation discrimination in various areas, including the provision of accommodation. The tribunal had also, unusually for Australia, in fact, to take into account a Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, which is a general Bill of Rights which applies in the state of Victoria. Those of you who don't know very much about Australia, it's a federal system like the United States, but we don't have a federal Bill of Rights of any sort. But two of the jurisdictions, the state of Victoria and the territory of the ACT, have adopted a version of the Bill of Rights. It doesn't operate exactly the same way as it does here, but this is something that was relevant, the tribunal thought, to these sorts of issues, and certainly will be relevant in the future. And one of the provisions, naturally, is that it contains, as you would expect, a right to freedom of religion and religious practice. The previous legislation's been replaced, but the current legislation is very similar. There are two exemptions then, or what I prefer to call balancing clauses, contained in the Equal Opportunity Act. The discourse of exemptions is very big in Australia, and a lot of complaints made about the fact that there are certain provisions in legislation which deal with freedom of religion. But I think that they are perfectly justified in terms of the value of freedom of religion. Section 75(2) of the Act said that nothing in Part 3 applies to anything done by a body established for religious purposes that conforms with the doctrines of the religion or is necessary to avoid injury to religious sensitivities. And Section 77 said nothing in Part 3 applies to discrimination by a person against another person if the discrimination is necessary for the first person to comply with the person's genuine religious beliefs or principles. Now, if you're following that, by the way, there is going to be copies of my full paper available by the end of today's session, so you can have that to look at later on. If you're following those two provisions closely, you will have noticed that 75 deals with religious organisations, or bodies rather, established for religious purposes, whereas Section 77 deals with persons. And one of the key issues that came up in this case was whether the organisation CYC could rely on an exemption that applied to persons and whether the law extended that way. Number of issues, not all of which I'll be able to deal with in today's presentation. A question as to whether the Victorian Charter was in fact relevant, and just to preempt that discussion of that in any way, the Court of Appeal, which was hearing the case that I'm dealing with now, so the after the tribunal's decision, the matter went on appeal to the Victorian Court of Appeal, and we have so that's the final Court of Appeal within the state of Victoria, three judges within the state of Victoria. And they ruled that the Victorian Charter was not relevant because the events had happened before the Charter commenced. But a big issue here was the relevant refusal by CYC discriminatory on the basis of the sexual orientation of the participants? Or could it be seen as based on the support that the weekend was going to offer for homosexual activity? And I think many religious believers around the world would like to maintain a valid distinction between the way that a person may be oriented or be inclined to engage in sexual activity and the actual engaging in that activity. And the CYC wanted to argue that they did not decline the booking on the basis of the orientation of the person's concern, but the support that was being provided for the activity of homosexual intercourse. So that was one of the issues that came up. There were technical issues about whether CYC alone was liable under the Act or whether both CYC and Mr. Rowe, their representative, were potentially liable, whether CYC could rely on the Section 75 defence applying to a body established for religious purposes, whether Mr. Rowe could rely on the Section 77 defence on the basis of, as a person, the necessity to comply with his own genuine religious beliefs or principles, and whether CYC as an incorporated body could rely on the Section 77 defence applying to persons. I will skip over the charter issue because it's mostly a matter of relevance to Australians, but that is for the future. The Victorian Charter, I think, will be of some significance in this area, but it wasn't in this case. CYC's argument about the distinction between orientation and behaviour was rejected by the court. The president of the court, President Maxwell, supported comments that had been made by the tribunal, which were to the effect that sexual orientation is a part of a person's being or identity, and that to distinguish between an aspect of a person's identity and conduct which accepts that aspect of the identity or encourages people to see that part of the identity as normal is to deny the right to enjoyment and acceptance of identity. And this is not a view that's unique to the tribunal or to the Victorian court. It's a view that was expressed in a case that some of you may know if you follow these decisions in the UK Supreme Court, Bull and Hall and Preddy in end of 2013, reported in 2014, where owners of a boarding house had declined accommodation to a homosexual couple in a double bedroom and were also convicted and fined. And as part of that, Lady Hale on the UK Supreme Court said, sexual orientation is a core component of a person's identity which requires fulfilment through relations with others of the same orientation. So we are moving to a discourse where if you are sexually oriented this way, you have to have the opportunity to fulfil yourself by a relationship with somebody else. Very, very different, of course, to traditional Christian teaching on morality and all those sorts of things. But this is the view that seems to be supported in the courts. And so they also considered in the process a Canadian decision called Ontario and Brockie, which held that a printing company was guilty of sexual orientation discrimination when refusing to print leaflets which promoted the cause of homosexual persons. And they said, look, we can't separate out the distinction between homosexual identity and activity, and therefore there was discrimination. Now, Brockie is actually very useful, I think, later on we'll see, for other purposes, but this idea that you can't separate out orientation from behaviour was one that was upheld in the case. I won't spend too much time on the question of institutional or individual liability because it's a matter that's very specific to this particular legislation, but to briefly summarise it, the president of the court thought that the liability of the corporation was direct rather than vicarious, and he thought that if the corporation was liable, the employee was not liable. The other members of the court, though, thought that both the organisation and Mr. Rowe, the individual officer, could be jointly and severally liable for the discrimination. The upshot of that finding, as we'll see at the end of the case, was that because one of the other judges thought that Mr. Rowe was not liable on the basis of a religious freedom exemption, that Mr. Rowe's conviction ended up being overturned in this case, but for two completely different reasons. That was the question that occupied a lot of time in the court. Probably the most interesting for our purposes is this question of the Section 75 defence, the balancing provision. Could CYC be said to be a body established for religious purposes? If so, was its refusal of accommodation justified by its doctrines? On the one hand, CYC was established by the Brethren denomination of the Church. It was required in accordance with its documents to operate in accordance with the fundamental beliefs and doctrines of the Christian Brethren. Other parts of its founding documents said that it had to create an obviously Christian atmosphere. Those who visited campsites should experience Christian life and values. It had power to advance to the trustees of the Brethren Church money for charitable purposes. And tellingly, all the members of the board were to subscribe to a Brethren Declaration of Faith. Looks like a religious body, doesn't it? No, not according to the Victorian Court of Appeal. That's not a religious body. Because when you go to their website, they didn't mention Christianity very explicitly. The name was buried down the bottom of the first page of the website, apparently. Secular groups booked it for football clubs and other organisations booked the camps. There was no prohibition of any particular type of activity offered on their advertising. Camps were not required to have any Christian comments. So for those reasons, Justice Maxwell said, no, this is not an organisation established for religious purposes. Very narrow view of religious purposes, in my view. Cited a previous case on charitable purposes, saying that the purposes themselves must be directly charitable. In the end, I think a very narrow view of what religion required in saying that CYC was not established for religious purposes. And yet that's the view that the court takes. Now, the result seems to be that even a body with explicitly faith-driven objects may be found in Australia to be not a body established for religious purposes if it engages in a wide range of community services which don't require the participants to make a faith commitment. And I think this is a bad policy outcome. I'm not sure if you have the Salvation Army operating over here. We have in Australia a very well-known organisation that provides care and services to the poor. They never stop a homeless person and say, are you a Christian or not, before they give them a sausage sandwich. But the fact is that this sort of view would say that groups like that might not even be bodies established for religious purposes. Those of us who are religious would probably argue that Jesus' teaching was that we should care for people, as we heard at lunch from the parable of the Good Samaritan. And that's a part of our religious commitment, but the court is narrowing down the definition of religion very closely. And even if it was, the court then said, a religious body, the court said that its defences couldn't apply to secular activities. The fact that CYC had voluntarily entered into the market for accommodation services meant that it had to behave in a way that did not allow consideration of doctrine. I think that many aspects of this decision are wrong, but I think this is one that's clearly problematic in terms of a body going into saying it loses its religious capacity simply because it goes into the market. There's also then a question of whether Christian doctrines about marriage are a central part of the Christian faith. And the court actually agreed with the tribunal judge, who had said, well, no, she put two experts up. Here's an expert from the left liberal wing of the church. Here's an expert from the evangelical wing of the church. She adopted the liberal gentleman's view that doctrines about sexuality are not really a core part of Christianity at all. All you've got to look at was the Nicene creeds and the historic Christian doctrines if you're talking about Christianity. And therefore, the tribunal judge said, and the court said, well, this is not a central part of Christianity, so you can't take your views on sexuality and justify activity. And in any case, doctrines of Scripture didn't require interference with those who chose to behave otherwise. And so therefore, the judge said they couldn't believe that this refusal was based on any genuine opinions about these sorts of things. Now, this is very problematic, of course. What we have is a secular court with absolutely no training about theology being asked to make a decision about what's the central doctrine of the Christian faith. It really can't be wrong. And Justice Redlich, who was the judge who dissented in the final decision in this case, said, look, this is neither human rights law nor the terms of the exemption require a secular tribunal to assess theological propriety. So I think that that's an area where the court should be challenged in the future. And this view that you must be acting in narrow conformity with your doctrine, you must be acting as required by doctrine rather than simply in accordance with doctrine, was a view that was discussed in the Awada case, for those of you who know it. In Europe, in the Awada case, a lady who worked for British Airways was ordered not to display a cross, and she successfully challenged that order in the European Court of Human Rights. So I might say even in the European Court of Human Rights, it was accepted that that was a breach of her religious freedom. But the sort of view adopted in the Victorian court would be, well, because no doctrine of Christianity makes you wear a cross, therefore your religious freedom is not protected. So there are all sorts of narrow views that are discussed here. And there is a similar approach taken to the question of religious sensibilities. Now, the fact that previously no inquiry had been made of the sexual practices of those attending was taken to mean that simply allowing homosexual persons to attend was not of itself an interference with religious sensibilities. But the fact is there's quite some difference, and Mr. Rowe gave evidence about this. He said, we've maybe had football clubs or community groups there where there've been homosexuals or lesbians there, and that's fine, we don't mind that. But when a group who's lobbying on behalf of a view that is completely contrary to our view of the biblical teaching on marriage asks us to take a booking, that is a different thing. And to take away an example, just the fact that they had not asked people about their political proclivities beforehand should surely not have precluded them from refusing a booking from a Nazi organisation that had come up and said, we want to make a booking. The fact is that there are all sorts of differences between those which the court didn't accept. Well, in the end then, from the Australian point of view, and I think one of the reasons that this case is legally wrong is that it doesn't take into account a very similar case decided in the New South Wales Court of Appeal, and New South Wales being another state of Australia, in 2010, where the court ruled that the Wesley Mission, which was offering fostering services for children, was entitled in accordance with its beliefs not to place a child with a gay couple. And that's a view that was accepted by the New South Wales court two or three years ago and yet wasn't really referred to by this court. So all sorts of issues here, I think. There was a question then as to whether Mr. Rowe was able to comply with his, you know, whether he could rely on the Section 77 defence about his genuine religious beliefs or principles, and mostly the court said no on similar reasons. You know, it's not a central part of your belief. It isn't required that you behave in this way. Now, I think what's interesting is and I'm not going to go into the other arguments here, but what I want to particularly talk about for a few minutes is Mr. Justice Redlich's view. How many more minutes do I have, Arthur, do you think? About two. Mm. Justice Redlich, if you're ever reading this decision, have a look at my paper if you get a chance. I think has a very good approach, because while he agrees with the court on some of these other issues, he says the Section 77 defence about complying with genuine religious beliefs or principles was applicable, and that should have been able to be used and relied on by Mr. Rowe. So it's a very significant case for Australia. There's an application for special leave being made to the High Court of Australia at the moment. And if you want to know how that's going, you can probably ask Neville. We don't know yet whether the High Court will give special leave, which is a sort of certiorari type equivalent over there. We hope they do, and we hope that some of the errors in this case might be overturned. Now, I've got another case that I want to talk about, so I'm going to quickly flick through to the other case. And the other case may be of some particular interest to people here. It's called Iliafi in the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. LDS wards in Brisbane had been offering Samoan language services for the community in that city. Leaders decided there that in the interest of reaching the wider community, the Samoan services would no longer be provided. A class action was then brought by a number of Samoan church members alleging breach of the Racial Discrimination Act against the church. And the Racial Discrimination Act prohibits racially discriminatory denial of various human rights. Three sets of human rights mentioned in the convention included right to nationality, right to freedom of thought and religion, and right to freedom of opinion and expression. The court did note, though, that it was not really clear how a claimed right, which was the right to worship publicly as a group in one's own language, really emerged from those specific rights. Now, it's a serious issue, of course, but the fact is, the court said, none of the international conventions give you a right to demand that your local church offer services in your own language. And I haven't got time to run it today, but if you ever get a chance to, if you want to understand something of the Australian legal mindset, you should watch a movie called The Castle. And in The Castle, there is this bumbling lawyer who stands up before the High Court, and when he can come up with no other argument as to why his client should win, he says, it's the vibe, Your Honour, it's the vibe. Well, this argument about somehow we run together these three rights and we come up with a vibe about the right to worship in your own language is kind of the way that this worked, and a similar result happened that was rejected by the full court. They said, look, yes, we will take into account the international jurisprudence, and the case is good because it's authority for Australian courts to look at Article 18 jurisprudence and European courts. But in the end, the claim failed because they said, While religious freedom is an important right, and while it extended as a right to religious organisations acting on behalf of their members, members of a religious body did not enjoy religious freedom rights that could be asserted against their religious body. They followed a decision in Romania. Interesting, we just heard about Romania, of course, where the court said, look, you don't get a religious freedom right against your own organisation. And indeed, they said that if the freedom of the Samoan worshippers was granted to worship in their own language, that was an interference with the religious freedom of the leaders of the church who were trying to organise the church in the way that they best saw fit. So in the end, the court said that in a way similar perhaps to the Hosanna Tabor approach of allowing churches to run their own internal affairs, that this was the way that it should work. Now, I think it's an interesting decision. I think it's a right decision, but it's a tricky one when you come down to the racial discrimination issues. I'm happy with the decision myself, but I'd be less happy if we had a church that said, actually, we're going to not let black people come to our meetings. It feels like that should be wrong. And yet, on the reasoning of the court in this case, they said, look, no, you know, and they said your right, religious freedom is protected by the fact that you can go to another church if you want to. So that's one of the issues is, are people's religious freedom protected by the fact that they can go and worship elsewhere? The court seemed to suggest that in this case they were. There may be other harder cases, I think, in the future. And the JFS case in England, if you know that one, is an illustration of some of the harder issues. In conclusion, I think it's an encouraging fact that the Australian courts are taking into account international cases. But as I say, and if you read my paper, you'll see this in more detail in the Cobourg case, if the courts are going to rely on international cases, they need to get them right. And I suggest that in the Cobourg case, they misread a couple of them. But the fact that the Australian courts are starting to look at the important human right of freedom of religion is an important development and to be welcomed. I'll finish there. Yeah. There you go. I wouldn't like to use the word plagiarism. But
it's very hard to plagiarise public documents, but there you go. well, ladies and gentlemen, it's really a pleasure to be here, and it's also a pleasure to come after such an eminent scholar as Neil, and who's done, I think, a very good job of his topic today. I am, though, minded of one of the Stoic philosophers about whom I was reading the other day, and in particular an anecdote about when he was beating a slave who had been caught stealing. And the slave protested, but according to Stoic doctrine, I was destined to steal. And Zeno replied, yes, that's true, but you're also destined to take a beating. Now, I think you're all destined to take a bit more of a beating today with our Australian accents and our idiosyncratic approach to the law, but let's see how we go. I'm conscious that Judge Wallace has been in and out of this meeting. I don't know where he is now, but I think he might have left in case I've committed a federal offence, because I do confess that in the paper I'm critical of one of your panels of the Seventh Court of Appeal, and that may be a federal offence. None of the students have been prepared to commit on that so far. I wouldn't have asked them that question. So I'll run the risk and I'll go a bit short on that part of it. In fact, I am talking about two cases today. I'm talking about a High Court decision. Now, our High Court is the equivalent of your Supreme Court. We have seven justices on that, and that is the Court of Last Resort in Australia. And you only get there by special leave, as Neil indicated. So I'm going to be talking about a decision that was made by that in the Commonwealth and ACT case, which is the same-sex case. And I'll also be talking about a recent decision of the Seventh Circuit of the US Court of Appeals. Baskin and Bogan, Wolf and Walker just decided a few weeks ago. So I'll be talking about that as well, just very briefly. Now, I can't really comment very much on the Cobourg case because I'm actually instructed in one part of that in the High Court at the moment. But I can say this, that a very similar case came up in the New York Division of Human Rights recently, the Liberty Ridge case. Some of you may have read that. And I am very critical of that case in a case note that I've published in the Notre Dame Sydney Law School website. That page is called On the Case. So if you want to see issue 7, you'll see what I have to say there. And given that it's very close to the COBOL case, you may guess what I might think about COBOL. Now, I have noticed in that terrible reread of your paper that there are a few persistent errors that I'm sure the BYU students put in there just to vex me. Or maybe I just left them there myself. We'll leave the jury out on that. But I will try and get a corrected version of that. The errors are fairly minor, but they are annoying nevertheless. But Neil has touched upon a few things, because in the COBOL case at the Court of Appeal level, there was the intervention by the International Council of Jurists. And I know that amicus briefs are a part of the jurisprudence of the United States and certainly part of the practice in the Supreme Court. I think the case that I'm going to be talking about today in Commonwealth and ACT has taught one thing to religious bodies, and that is they should take the idea of intervening in high court cases that raise religious freedom issues, albeit peripherally, they should take that issue very seriously indeed, lest they get some stray comments that they can't deal with afterwards. But at the end of it, although I'll be talking to 6 points today, at the core of same-sex marriage and both the adoption and the push for it, there seems to me to be something that's very large, at least in the Australian debate. Those who oppose it generally are religiously motivated, with the exception of a couple of very eminent scholars, one of whom is Professor Anne Toomey, whom I quote in the paper. She, as far as I know, has no religious convictions of any particular type at all, but has come up with very strong policy and constitutional arguments against the concept and argues very eloquently against it, in my respectful view. So generally, the opposition is ideologically driven. I don't think anyone should be embarrassed to say that. That is the fact. But even if it's ideologically driven, it still has to pass the appropriate legal hurdles. And so far, those objections have done so. In fact, one of my colleagues and I have appeared before a number of parliamentary committees, both the Senate and the House of Representatives federally, and then each of the state parliaments that have proposed this. And we've persuaded each of them, both on legal and policy grounds, that it would not be a good idea to pass that type of legislation. And in fact, there was a report just published by our Senate in the last week, where they said in terms that they agreed with the submissions we'd made in that. So far, arguments have held the thing together. Some people may say it's a finger in the dike. Some may say it's turning the tide. But ideology, I think, falls into two parts. For those who propound the idea of same-sex marriage as being a good legal construct to impose upon our society, I think they're driven by the romanticism perhaps of a ceremony. I think that may be part of it. Maybe by the concept of permanence. But I think at the core of it is to get rights to adoption. And Australia does not have rights to adoption universally. There are a few exceptions, but it does not have rights of adoption for gay couples at the moment. If marriage were granted to them, then there would be no resistance to that. And that is the point of all of this. Once you've given gay couples the right to adopt, it seems to me that the argument over same-sex marriage is very hard to resist. I'm not saying it's insurmountable, because it still has to pass the legal and policy hurdles, but a lot of the objection must go away. And so I think at the end of the day, the core question is really, what is in the interest of the child? It's all very well to talk about the rights of the adults that are involved in the relationship, but how does it affect the child? Now, certainly the jury is out on the sociology of this so far. But I think on balance, although the evidence is still early and still rather thin in terms of research, it still seems to preponderate in favour of two biological different sex parents raising a child as being the best paradigm in which to raise them. Now, I don't think that's an unfair reading of the literature, but I'm not a sociologist. I'm a lawyer. I just go with the evidence that I can find. But it seems to me the great tragedy in Baskin and Bogan is that none of that evidence was given any airplay at all It just seems to have been completely overlooked, not only in the reasons for judgment, but it seems also in the way the case was presented. And I find that, as a lawyer who appears in court quite a bit, quite an astonishing outcome. I just find that absolutely astounding. But anyway, not to dwell on that too much, because somebody might start throwing stones at me for being critical of your Court of Appeal. Perhaps I can start by going into that case of the High Court. Now, the case of the High Court was delivered late last year. The reasons for decision were handed down very quickly. The Federal Attorney General intervened, largely, one would like to think, at the urging of a lot of religious bodies. A lot of religious bodies wrote to him and said, and to the Prime Minister, and said, you cannot let this case go. It is unconstitutional. It's got everything wrong about it. You, as the attorney, should take this up, and he did indeed. Baskin and Bogan was actually the states of Wisconsin and I think it was Illinois from memory. I may be wrong on that, but that was basically also an appeal from first instance courts where the states were involved. Now, interestingly, in the first case, the High Court decided that a federal law rendered a territory law on same-sex marriage invalid, constitutionally invalid. So in other words, they struck down the same-sex law. In the Seventh Circuit, what they did was they struck down the Constitution in favour of the same-sex law. To us, as Australians looking on, that is perverse. Now, that's all I'll say that is negative. I just find that very strange, and I've tried to follow the 14th Amendment reasoning. It's counterintuitive. It seems like a house of cards that is just waiting for the bottom card to be pulled out, but it seems to be gaining acceptance by increasing numbers of courts. So let's go to the background of the Commonwealth and the ACT. The Federal Marriage Act, which is a piece of federal legislation, because in 1961 it was decided as a policy that Australia should have one marriage law, and there were concurrent legislative powers in the states and the federal government, but under our constitution, if the federal government legislates, it excludes all state legislation on the same subject. So the 1961 Marriage Act was passed with that in mind, to get rid of this multitude of state laws and to have a sensible, comprehensive code in the Marriage Act defining and containing marriage. That act was amended in 2004 to actually, for the first time, define what was meant by marriage. And I should say that at that stage, there was no hint that any state would even try and pass same-sex marriage laws. No one said that was the case. And so what they did was they passed this amendment, and it defined marriage in the typical hide-and-hide style with which we're all familiar, as being the voluntary union of a man and a woman for life to the exclusion of all others. So the elements that are important from the hide-and-hide definition are that, first of all, there is free choice in whom you marry. There can be no arranged or forced marriages. It has to be heterosexual, has to be permanent, has to be monogamous. And that was what the Act was intended to do. There's also an amendment at Section 88AE, which said that no same-sex marriage contracted overseas will be recognised in Australia as a same-sex marriage. So your President Obama has sent a same-sex couple as the ambassador to Australia. As soon as they got off the plane, they were no longer married in Australia. That was the end of it. Whatever they might think happens anywhere else, they are not married in Australia. So what happened was that the ACT, which is a territory of Australia, it's the actually the capital territory, so it's the equivalent of DC, where Canberra is and where the federal parliament sits and where the High Court sits. It narrowly won government. When I say narrowly, it was by 46 votes. So it was a very narrow win, and it gained government only by obtaining the support of a very radical party. They should be called the Reds, but they are called the Greens, on a promise of introducing same-sex marriage legislation in the territory. Now, as I said, other jurisdictions had all been persuaded that they had no power to do so because of Section 109, which is the invalidating section and the prohibition on states legislating in a field where the federal parliament has already legislated. And we call that usually covering the field. And so the Marriage Act, being a code, had covered the field. There was a similar provision in the Self-Government Act of the ACT, which is Section 28, meaning that their unicameral little micro-parliament could not pass an act that would be contrary to any federal parliament act, where you've got a fully elected bicameral parliament with a House of Representatives and the Senate. This little pipsqueak of a parliament could not go against them. But that did not dissuade these mice from roaring. But there were concerns that were expressed prior to the legislation being passed about the impact that it would have upon religious freedom. In fact, the Australian Christian Lobby, who's one of my clients, they actually wrote a letter to the Territory Attorney General and said, well, look, we're worried about the way in which religious freedom seems to be impacted by same-sex marriage. It seems that as soon as that right is granted, there is a contracting of religious freedom consequentially upon that entry into the jurisprudential space. And they cited a few examples and gave air to their concern. And the letter is actually cited in my paper, and you can read it at leisure in the relevant part. But the Attorney General wrote back and said, yes, that is the consequence, and yes, they will have to behave themselves, including having to provide goods, services, and facilities. He adds the word facilities, which means a building or whatever it might be. They have to supply those facilities so that they do not act in a discriminatory way if requested by a same-sex couple who have just been married. So the concerns were well-grounded, well-justified, and that legislation was passed and declared by the High Court to be invalid under Section 28 because the Marriage Act evinced an intention to cover the legislative field. But then you get all sorts of surprises in High Court judgments, but what happened was marriage equality, which is one of the groups that is engaged in lobbying for same-sex marriage and for LGBT rights generally in Australia, had intervened in the case and made submissions. And so the High Court went on and delivered a very long set of obiter dicta where they started, and it was totally contrary to the normal common law tradition in our country that they would do so, but they started deciding cases in advance of those that they'd heard so that this issue would never come before them again. It would become an issue for Parliament, and said the marriage power is very wide. It could, of course, they could legislate for same-sex marriage at the federal level, and of course they could legislate for polygamy. So there was a little bit in it for everybody. The gays weren't very happy about being associated with polygamy. They've always wanted to keep that separate, and the Christians weren't very happy about being told definitively that the originalist arguments that they would want to run in the High Court in a future case would not be entertained at all. And the High Court came up with some interesting terminology. They called the marriage power a topic of juristic classification. Now, Professor Toomey has searched the cases, I've searched the cases, and I've only been able to find that in one previous case where it was in a dissenting decision which actually went contrary to the way in which the High Court used that term in this particular case. But that's by the by. It was quite an extraordinary use to say that it's a malleable power and it is informed by customs and traditions in relation to marriage in other countries. Now, at the moment, the majority of countries do not have same-sex marriage. So one would think that would contract the power. Not so according to the High Court, and they've left that hot potato as a political one rather than a judicial one. So as a result, there's an increased uncertainty by virtue of the obiter dicta that were attached to the essential part of the decision in the ratio deus addendi. So we're uncertain about this new method of constitutional interpretation. It went contrary to all previous practices. They only chose two of the hide and hide elements of marriage to light upon as being the flexible ones. What about some of these things like polygamy? Well, they said that's okay. But what about underage marriage? What about non-consensual marriage? They're all elements, or at least one of them is an element of hide and hide. Why is that not up for grabs as well? Why not within this new juristic classification can there be a great expansion to embrace Islamic practices where millions of people have underage marriages that aren't necessarily consensual? Why not? So it doesn't make sense. It rather adds some uncertainty. But at least the ratio dies addendi is pretty clear. No state or territory can pass such a law. Now, Baskin and Bogan, the only comments I'll make are those that are on this slide. It was a style of judging that I really haven't come across very much. I've never seen a judge write like that. It was Judge Posner. Now, I've known of Judge Posner for many years because I'm a competition lawyer. I've read lots of his writings and some of his antitrust work, but it's extraordinary, just extraordinary, at least in our tradition. A judge would not write like that in our jurisdiction. And he proceeds upon an assumption in writing for the court of this inevitability. He must have an amazingly brilliant crystal ball because he seems to know everything that's going to happen. The whole thing is premised on inevitability. He used the 14th Amendment in a way that I respectfully say I have to find somewhat counterintuitive as an outsider, but I'm not qualified to comment on that, and I'm sure someone will get up and correct me about my assumptions in that area. He makes factual assumptions that are extraordinary and leaps in logic that I have to say border on the absurd. And he uses all of that weak and contrived logic ultimately to say that the state constitution was invalid in defining marriage between a man and a woman. It's breathtaking. It's just breathtaking. I've never seen anything like it. But that seems to be de rigueur among courts of appeal at the moment, with the many circuits allowing same-sex marriage. The mental gymnastics and the pyrotechnics of precedent that they have to engage in is quite astonishing. It's impressive. And he overlooks basic authorities. I would have thought that he would look at least at the most recent decision of the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights, where they said on similar propositions that are found in your own Bill of Rights, they say that there is no right to insist on a state giving same-sex marriage. It is not a fundamental human right. It is only when the state legislates that there is such a right. But without legislation, that state cannot be forced to give you same-sex marriage. Completely overlooked, and also, as also is the reasoning of Feldman J of the District Court in Louisiana in Robichaux and Caldwell, where he impeccably, I think, reasons the logic on the 14th Amendment, and basically says that all of the circuits of the Court of Appeal have just overlooked basic logic and reasoning. So I leave that with you. Now, so what do these cases mean? In my paper, I have asked a question, and the question that I ask really is whether we're heading to some sort of modern dystopian society that possibly would have only found itself in fiction some years ago. Are all the previously held mores now just up for grabs? Is everything gone, and is there just no hope? I read just recently that the German Parliament was advised by its ethics committee that they could see nothing wrong with sibling incest. There's nothing wrong with, in fact, there was actually a right for siblings to be able to have sexual relations. There can be nothing morally wrong with that. And in fact, a judge in New South Wales just in the last couple of weeks also said, well, now that we accept gay rights, now that we accept this, now that we accept that, why should sibling incest be a crime? I can't see what the difference is. Everything's going out the window. Why should we make a big deal about that? And so the question is whether we're approaching this inevitable nihilism in the way that we view the world that really answers the idiom that if God does not exist, and I interpolate by saying in the public square, then everything is permissible. And in my paper, I conjecture on some antidotes that are being explored by people like Jeremy Waldron and others as to where we might go. But I don't think we have an answer, but I think the answer has to be in maintaining freedom of religion and that place in the public square. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. First, let me say how much of a thrill it is to be sharing a panel with these esteemed members of this conference. It's a real thrill to be here. I should also say thank you for the opportunity to give a contribution on what are some really, really pressing issues in Australia, but also I know certainly here in this country and elsewhere. Thinking about the Australian context, I won't go over the legal matters and some of the cases that have already been discussed by Professor Rockow and also Professor Foster. But it did occur to me as I was listening to them that it occurred to me that part of what they're offering is both a reasonable voice in the Australian context, but also something of a countercultural voice as things are going. There's a very famous comic strip in Australia called The Phantom. You don't need to be aware of that, but it's quite popular. It's even more popular in Australia than The Batman, okay? And in that comic strip, over its now 70-something year history, the Phantom has visited Australia only once, only once. And when he did so, there's a comic strip panel that I remember very, very clearly where he steps into a pub or what you would call a bar in Sydney. He orders himself a glass of milk because one of his character traits is that he doesn't drink alcohol. And he's surrounded by all these rough-looking characters, and he stares out the window, looks at the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and he says, as he sips his milk, "Nowhere else in the world will you find such a desperate din of sin and depravity as in Sydney, Australia." I'd like to think that Neville and Neil are great exceptions to this rule. Okay, so let me just say I'm really grateful for their contribution in an ongoing conversation that has become very, very important. I think looking over the cases that they've discussed and some of the strangeness in the decision-making around those cases in our courts in Australia, it's clear that we're going through significant change, not just legally, but with ramifications in terms of our wider culture in the Australian context. So I want to be fairly brief this afternoon. I just want to make a couple of observations that I make not as a lawyer or as a legal theorist. I teach theology in a Catholic university, and I also have the privilege of working for a Catholic bishop in the Australian context. So some very brief observations that I just want to put before you. The first is that in the Australian context, there are a couple of things that we lack, if you like, in terms of our historical record and what we refer to as our historical narrative. So everybody has a story, every country has a story or a narrative that it draws from and that it thinks through when it's considering change, when it's moving in one direction or another. One of the things we lack, I think, is what you might call serious religious conflict in Australian history. And by that I mean not that we haven't had moments of religious violence or sectarianism, we certainly have had those things, and we've certainly had moments of religious passion in which religion has played an important part in our history. But we can't look back and refer to any particular event or set of events concerning religious violence or religious conflict in the way that other countries around the world, both in what you might call the older world or the newer world, can do so. There's one notable exception to that, and that is the history between our first peoples, or our Indigenous peoples in Australia, and their religious and cultural traditions, and what happened in our colonial history. But thinking in terms of the sort of the constitutional settlement of Australia that we've had since 1901 when we became a federated country, there's no real history within that context outside of that important and significant example that I just referred to. The second is that we don't, or this is a lack if you like, we don't have or we lack a profound political change, okay, in our historical narrative. And that is to say we don't have a particular moment or period of history in which we went through dramatic change, such as, for example, revolution, or civil war in the way that other countries like the United States has experienced. We've certainly had lots of political characters over the years. We've had moments of great passion. We've had one or two moments of what you might call constitutional crisis. But generally speaking, the outcome of those were fairly successful in terms of finding a fairly non-violent, peaceful resolution, even if you might have disagreed on aspects of certain decisions, whether you're on the left or the right in Australian political history. So we haven't gone through a revolution, we haven't gone through a civil war. We're a country which has managed to avoid that kind of religious conflict. The third is that when we look at our history, it's a fairly, what I call, a low-octane set of compromises. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you might look at some histories of some nations and think of moments as being fairly high octane, high energy, high passion, moments where you can refer to a great speech or passing of significant legislation or something which rises the passions and energies of a people. And in a sense, we have more a history of generous compromise in Australia, a history in which we have a constitution which has generally worked quite well. And if you read through it, I actually recommend reading through it, particularly if you have a long flight and you're in need of sleep. Okay? This is not an exciting document or a set of texts. Okay? It's all about the balance of power and separating the powers between our states, territories, and our federal parliament, and therefore what powers our government has. So with those three things that might be missing, if you like, a lack of political, serious religious conflict, a lack of serious political conflict, but also just the nature of our history. That's not to say there haven't been moments of passion, etc., but when we step back and we think of our historical narrative, we don't have some of those features. Now, why is that so important? I just cast a glance at those things because I think what Neil and Neville have highlighted today is that we are now going through very dramatic change, both in the directions and hints of where things might be going in our courts, as well as the legislation that's being offered up in our various parliamentary houses, but also as part of that, that we're going through a cultural change. Many of us have been saying for a while that much of the cultural battle on the issue of same-sex marriage has already been lost in many respects. If you look at anything in popular culture, if you look at anything on television, or if you read even the more conservative newspapers and news publications, there is a real hospitality to that question that was unimaginable just over a decade ago. So we're going through serious cultural change. Now, the thing about cultural change is that it can happen without you really noticing. And that's part of the reason I think people are having trouble noticing the significance, because we don't have precedent in major historical change in terms of religion or politics, which we can draw from. There's not precedent for this quite in the way that would be helpful to us, to be able to look back and say, well, when we faced this significant change before, this is how we handled it. To quote someone from the Christian tradition, C.S. Lewis, who some of you I'm sure are familiar with, he said at one point, the great tragedy of Christian history is that at every moment that we were most needed, we were too late. And there's that sense in which stepping back on issues that affect a range of people in a range of religious traditions, it's quite easy for those changes to happen without noticing, which is why I think when we have theorists, commentators, leaders who are noticing and who are willing to articulate a different approach, something more generous in terms of our history and our self-understanding, but something which is also more careful and committed to the liberty of those with a religious commitment to be able to live freely and to live that faith out freely. I think that's highly significant that we give every encouragement to those people and into those contexts. So I make those observations, those three, I think, matters that we lack in terms of our historical narrative, but also that this results in a great challenge for us. And just by a word of conclusion, I think it really results in three significant challenges. One is how to educate people on these sorts of questions and issues when the culture has already moved on. The second is how to mobilize people, how to activate energies and an interest in dealing with these sorts of questions. But the third, and this is something that I'm keen to hear from others as well about, and that is how to actually inspire any passion about these kinds of questions. Okay, and in a country like Australia where we value the fact that we can share a barbecue, if you like, with our neighbours and spend the entire 3 hours at their home not once mentioning politics or religion. Okay, that's the kind of culture in which Australians find themselves, in which we value an avoidance of some of those issues. How then do we educate, mobilise, but also ignite some kind of passion? Now, as someone who teaches theology, I think there are religious resources to draw from that we can do that, but I think there are probably other resources as well. So let me say thank you once again for the opportunity to make a contribution, and especially thanks to Neil and to Neville today. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you. Thanks to all of you for coming as well, too. I want you to know, as the moderator, it's not easy, having just met two of these fine gentlemen, and the names are Neil, Neville, and Nigel. Those are I've called Neil, Nigel once, and Nigel, Neil, I think, going through this. Hey, I just wanted to take a real short moment. I assisted the barrister with the argument on the Elifa case, which we refer to in the church as the Samoan Language Unit case. And I think you might find this interesting. There were 61 members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who commenced the proceeding claiming that their religious freedom rights had been infringed with the mode, and this is key, the mode of delivery of the service went from English to Samoan. Now, those who are members of the LDS Church here knows that delivery of the service is how the sermons are given, how the testimonies are born, and so on. What happened was, because the young youth wanted to speak English, that was one of the reasons why the decision was made by President Hinckley at the time to convert it to an English-speaking unit. So all members are still welcome to come. They could bear their testimony in their native language, as we know, if they had an opportunity, or say a private prayer. But Justice Kinney, on behalf of the court in the judgment that Neil referred to, wrote a well-reasoned judgment. And the key words are the appellants, that would be the 61 Samoan-speaking members. The appellants failed to establish the existence of the right to worship publicly, and this is key, as a group, not individually, as a group, in their native language at the respondents' services, so at the church's services, of public worship. Because you can see the practical problem there would be if a member could insist that the service, the public service, is given in their language, because you could have a Samoan sitting next to a German, sitting next to a Frenchman, sitting next to an Englishman. It would just be impractical to be able to run that. Now, I'm pleased to say all but three of those 61 are back attending church. Their youth are, their children are happy. But as a French Canadian, as a Canadian with French Canadian, which we Canadians live with, James can understand that, that the importance of hanging on to your language, I don't discredit that at all. From a father's point of view, I would want my children, if I was French, to speak French at school, to speak French at home, to speak French at church, to try to hang on to that heritage. Now, having said that, the time is well spent. If there are any questions that you need to ask, you can certainly come to the group afterwards, if that's all right with the two of you. And I ask you, thank you all for coming. Really appreciate you being here. And ask you all to please join me in thanking these wonderful and learned scholars.